But actually, every day you walk onto the sand, it's incredibly stimulating and exciting. Every time you want, you see what the new set is. Every time you see a new script. Every time you discover who the new guest stars are going to be. Every time you get to be Doctor Who, which is what happens to me. I go to work and I've got to try and be Doctor Who. That remains for me immensely exciting.
These are the Target Files, Doctor Who, Season 10 Reviews. Join us now as we discuss the final season of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor and Stephen Moffat as showrunner.
Hello and welcome to the festive edition, episode 57 of Doctor Who Target Files. This is Mike in Swansea.
And hello, this is Alex in Exeter.
This time we are discussing two now interlinked stories in the Doctor Who universe. First is the 10th Planet novelisation, released at the beginning of this month, December 2017, as an audiobook performed by actress Annika Wills, who played Polly in the original story. And we're also going to be discussing the very end of the Stephen Moffat and Peter Capaldi era, Twice Upon a Time, which has a link to this story. So, Al, shall we start with the 10th Planet?
Yeah, let's start with 10th Planet. You know, it's a TV episode. It has sort of invention of the Cybermen, what we know now, and it has, you know, themes of snow, and then it has the first ever regeneration, which is you know, important because that never happened before. But now we know why it happened. It's all been nicely linked to Twice Upon a Time.
My initial thoughts on this book were full of morality. Pretty relentlessly gloomy for a regeneration story. I can't remember too many of them being too happy, the last story for each Doctor, and we've seen that again this Christmas. Lots of morality in there, lots of body horror with the introduction of the Mondasian Cybermen. How do you feel that's been dealt with by Moffat now? We find out that their planet Telos was blowing up, and they've made their way here, so this is actually a separate bunch, isn't it, from Mondasian Cybermen, from the ones we saw Bill turned into on a ship at the finale of Season 10?
Yeah, I think it's all been nicely, in the last couple of Stephen Moffing, nicely connected. And yeah, there's a good bit at the beginning of the book where they explain the whole sort of reason why they're on Earth and at the South Pole. And I think that works really well now.
Yes, in the Season 10 finale, World Enough in Time and the Doctor Fours, they were called. It's explained that it was an exodus, wasn't it, onto this ship which is going into a black hole.
Yeah, that's the reason they're there, because they're trying to escape, basically, and, you know, breathe somewhere else, basically. That's the point of the last two Doctor Who episodes of Season 10.
Yes, very cleverly done by Stephen Moffat, because it doesn't trample on the excellent Spare Parts Big Finish play as well.
Yeah, that's well worth a listen, Spare Parts, because it's a brilliant, another sort of gives you another background to the Cybermen's birth as well. But yeah, I think the connection between, you know, what's happened over Christmas and 10th Planet works really well, I think.
But staying on the 10th Planet, Ben, Polly and the First Doctor arrive at the South Pole. Becomes one of those sort of base and just siege stories very quickly.
It's got really fast pace, you know, they sort of find the base under siege very quickly in the book, and it's under some snow, and then they're immediately involved in it. It has that really sort of fast pace you get sometimes in Doctor. I think it works.
Yeah, a few sort of slight stereotypes of the 60s, which we also saw dealt with in Twice Upon a Time very recently, just this week on Christmas Day. There's the idea of a few people being on their bunk beds in the base, a few of the soldiers, and one of them sees something out in the snow via the telescope, don't they? And there's no sort of interest in what they see. They think it's a bit of a joke, and then he mentions it's a woman, and we get this sort of, I think he's an Italian, isn't he, character jumping up off the bed saying, "A woman!" And I was almost expecting him to say, "Mamma mia," you know, for the full-on Italian stereotype of that time.
Oh, totally, totally. He's such a stereotype of Italian, and they sort of gently brought those sort of things back. What, you know, make, what the doctor in Twice Upon a Time, what the doctor can't believe what this other doctor is still saying. It's so they're really funny bits.
Yes, and staying on the 10th planet, of course, we get the introduction of a character I think is key to this story, is Cutler. Probably gets more of a major role even than the Doctor himself, but in terms of the morality in this tale and how it goes along.
Oh, most definitely. I think Cutler does have a really big role, because we know the way this story's laid out, but William Hartnell wasn't very well, so the Doctor doesn't do as much as he normally would in a book. And I think Cutler does more, and he becomes the sort of main character, I think.
But I'd almost forgotten, Al. I'd listened to it in segments, and I decided I had a bit of spare time this morning, so I decided to listen to most of it again in one go. But Cutler himself also gets sidelined, of course. He gets knocked out for a certain period of the book, as Hartnell was, because of his illness, and because he was on holiday, I think, in episode 3, and they had the stand-in.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. There is that bit, yeah. It's a sort of all the major characters, but either get knocked out or sidelined, really. And then the smaller people, like, you know, with the Doctor, Polly and Ben take more of a role, really.
Yes, anything else really stood out for you? Scientifically, we know that Jerry Davis had come on board with the series at this point, and there was a move towards more scientific-based stories towards this episode and the start of the subsequent Patrick Troughton era.
He's not, I think, yeah, definitely, there's definitely a more scientific element. There's more, you know, with cybernetics to do with the Cybermen and taking, you know, body parts that don't work and turning them in, you know, getting cybernetics and making them work. And moon-based stuff at the beginning, when they're in the, you know, the spaceship and it generally goes wrong. So I think there are quite a lot of scientific language in this book, I think.
Yeah, but it never really gets bogged down with it. Chops and changes somewhat. It's pretty full on with the action, even though if you consider the TV version, they're really sort of set within just a couple of rooms, aren't they, you know, within the base itself, and of course Geneva on Earth.
Yeah, it is a pretty tight production, I agree. It doesn't go through many sets. There are, like, as you said, four rooms about it. But I think it doesn't get bogged down too much. I would agree on that with scientific language. There's a lot of science stuff going on. I think it manages to do both, I think.
This was filmed 1966. There's a real feel that they've tried to go for the 1960s James Bond type epic scale, haven't they, with all the various communications around the world to Geneva and the moon and the peril of Cutler's son being trapped aboard this spaceship.
Oh, most definitely. It definitely has a sort of filmatic. It reminds me a lot, if we're going to pick James Bond, it reminds me a lot of Moonraker, and the sort of bigger feel to got to like we have now. What for back then must have been, you know, pretty impressive.
You Only Live Twice, I think, was made a year later, and it's definitely got elements of that.
But the base bit in You Only Live Twice, definitely.
But an interesting decision in the book. It was made to set this in the year 2000, whereas the actual TV story is set in 1986. Did you see any sort of particular reason for that?
Maybe, I didn't personally, but I think maybe they did that because, you know, 2000 seems very sort of, not now, what seems back then, very sort of spacey and, you know, far away. So maybe, or with, I can see, you know, with the TV version, maybe that's not too far away, you know, 86 or 6, you know, so that you can sort of get round your head on that, I think.
Yes, and then when you consider the Dalek invasion of Earth on television is set in the year 2000, but the Peter Cushing film adaptation is 2150.
Oh, yeah, they do seem to do that in Doctor Who, different time sort of periods, and I think it does work sometimes.
It was the childhood Stephen Moffat getting his wibbly-wobbly ways in straight away.
Well,
more about Stephen later. And we also get a bit of futurism, I suppose you could say, in the book compared to the TV version as well, with Ben when he's locked up in the film projection room, and he actually says he's watching a James Bond film, which actually wasn't made when this first story was filmed in 1966. He seems to me to be describing Roger Moore in The Man with the Golden Gun, which was 1974, being a Bond geek as well as I am.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. Well, that's true. Yeah, there's definitely some trying to put in relevant things to other things, I think, in this.
And what did you think of the menace of the Cybermen? We can talk about the voices in a minute. They brought back the excellent Nick Briggs, and I thought he really captured the sort of harmonica sing-song voice of those Mondasian Cybermen.
I think that they are really paced out well in the book, and definitely in the TV episode as well. And I just think they're really, I think they are the most creepiest Cybermen, the Mondasian ones, because they look so close to human sometimes. There's some beautiful shots in this. Fingertips look really great and horrific. And I think, yeah, like you, I think Nick Briggs has really got the sing-songy sort of Cybermen from that period really well in this.
Yeah, someone was commenting online about the version they used. They showed the black and white version in Twice Upon a Time, and they said, they've left sellotape on the Cybermen in HD. What are they doing in this era?
I was interested, really, somebody get that picky with them.
Yes, you know what? Well, you know what the net is like. I think it was posted sarcastically, so...
Yeah, I think so, because I thought that bit was brilliant.
Annika Wills. Polly, we've met her a number of times at Regen in Swansea. Oh, Al, lovely, see? Lovely lady. And we saw her at the BFI for the Power of the Daleks animation screening just over a year ago. How do you felt she attacked this book?
I think she attacks it really, really well. And she gets most characters' voices right, I think. And I just think, you know, she's just fantastic whatever she does. You know, even having that two-minute cameo in Twice Upon a Time, that was just... Even that little bit was brilliant.
Not the best lucky like again. As in Adventure in Space and Time, she really wasn't happy with that actress playing her. I'm not sure she has said yet or tweeted yet what she thinks of. I think Lily Travers is the name of the actress who had a very brief role as her in Twice Upon a Time.
No, I haven't seen anything yet on her Twitter feed yet. Well, I expect she'll be saying something knowing Annika.
And there has actually been a Doctor Who extra where they've shown some scenes which they didn't include in Twice Upon a Time, which they filmed taken from the 10th Planet again, so she did get a little bit more screen time there.
Yeah, I just think with her voice, you can do Hartnell really well, and he does Ben very well. I think he does cover every base, I think, very well in this audiobook.
Going on to that Christmas special, now they're linked again, but she did Ben a hell of a lot better than the guy in Twice Upon a Time did, if I'm honest.
yeah, he wasn't the greatest, I have to admit, in Twice Upon a Time. Ben wasn't.
He's very sort of cheeky, chirpy Cockney, wasn't he, Michael Craze? Annika tells a story when she did her first convention in the 90s and she hadn't seen him for 20 years and they'd arranged to meet at a train station and she just heard over her shoulder, "Hello, Duchess."
It's just great, isn't it? Well, I think, isn't that the guy who's doing Ben for Big Finish who was in Twice Upon a Time? Is it Elliot Chapman, isn't it?
Oh, it's the same one, is it? I hadn't actually realised.
I think it might have been.
Because the looks weren't great either, guys, you know, even... Just my opinion, but we'll go on to that in Twice Upon a Time shortly.
I see where you're coming from, so I agreed.
I want to return, if I can, Al, to Cutler. He's one of those fascinating characters you can have sympathy for 1 minute and then completely turn on him again the next. Yet you're left with this feeling of sadness. Spoilers, folks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. At the end, that he doesn't find out that his son has survived up in space on this craft.
No, he's a really interesting character, Cutler, because I agree. You know, 1 minute he's really fighting to save the base, then he's a real sort of evil guy, and he's happy, and he sort of flips in all emotion, I think, you know. And that the one thing at the end where he doesn't know what's happened really does change him.
It's hard to pin down, isn't it? Because it's... You can't say it's a sense of duty, because halfway through he goes against his crew. He wants to show himself in charge by telling Geneva on Earth that he'll only take measures when he needs to, but then he immediately decides he wants to use the Z-bomb on the Cybermen.
Definitely. He sort of flips between the two, sort of, I will fight for the base, and then things happen. It sort of changes every 2 minutes, because it's a really good thing with a character.
Yes, interesting omission in the book, I noticed. The love, pride, hate, fear mix that we saw in Twice Upon a Time. The line
it's
about having...
There,
a, yeah. The first line is the love, pride, hate, fear, but he doesn't say, Hartnell's doctor, the first doctor, doesn't say in the novelisation, "Do you have no emotions, sir?" which is the key moment of the morph in the special.
Yeah, I did notice that line wasn't there. Obviously, it's become a very famous line now, but perhaps they didn't add it in the book or something.
And did you feel it was quite an abrupt ending for the Cyber Leader, in terms of the main Cyberman threat is over with fairly quickly in this book, although we get the added sort of build-up towards the end of the Doctor and Polly on the Cybermen spacecraft?
Yeah, it did feel a little bit rushed. You know, he was there 1 minute and killed the next. It did feel a little bit rushed, to be honest.
And then moving towards the end, Al, the Doctor tells Ben and Polly that it's far from being all over. He walks out in the snow. I wonder what could happen there, eh?
Indeed, as we all sort of have an answer to that now, what is at the time, walking towards the TARDIS to regenerate, we didn't know.
And then it's on to the big regeneration reveal. Thankfully, that one survived when 10th Planet Episode 4 got borrowed by the Blue Peter Studio in the mid-70s, but it hasn't been seen since, unfortunately.
No, it's a bit of a shame, but you know, on the recent 10th Planet, they did the animation thing again, and at the end, which does look fairly good, and it's sort of a great little effect, but I think didn't get really get thought of much at the time, but it's a good effect still to this day, and as we know, other things happen now.
The regeneration, Al, they do change it slightly in the book, don't they? We seem to have the Doctor lying down in some sort of side room in the TARDIS.
Yeah, it's more like a sort of the zero gravity rooms we have later on in other sort of Peter Davis period and that, but I think it's more interesting in the episode we just see him walk into the TARDIS and sort of lying on the floor till he turns into Patrick Troughton, really.
And I think we more or less get the same type of speech, don't we?
Pretty similar speech to, you know, what we normally get at the end, you know, what we got pretty close to Patrick, you know, I think Peter Capaldi's speech was fantastic, which was pretty close to William Hartnell's.
I'm looking at the covers, a Chris Achilleos original, the first edition, 1976. I already got that sort of, I would say lifelike quality, but they are Cybermen, to it. The Mondasians, one in profile on its side, one facing just off the sort of main frame. Mondas in front of the Earth, behind the Earth. Some various flames coming off it. The Doctor isn't there, though. Is that sometimes an issue for us when we don't have the Doctor on the cover?
I think it can be, because you don't sort of know where you're going. Well, I think it's not a bad one, because all the Cybermen, I think I would have still been interested. You know, I think a Doctor Who cover always should have the Doctor on, personally.
And then Alistair Pearson had a go at a reprint in 1993. The McCoy logo with that funny sort of ribbon, the 10th Planet. We do have a lovely photorealistic shot of Hartnell, looking slightly like he's got an orange suntan, though, because there's an orange background behind him with two Mondasian Cybermen standing either side of the planet and the Cyber Controller in front with a lovely black handlebar over his head. That's a pretty good one. I'd say they're pretty evens. Probably Chris Achilleos is
I'd probably go with the Chris Achilleos, because it's really nice, but maybe, you know, if it added the Doctor, it would be even better, I think.
Chris Achilleos is just maybe shades it for me.
And, yeah, it's really nice.
They had the 2012 reprint. The Doctor Who gold logo. In the background, Jerry Davis. And it was pretty well recreated on the cream-coloured background. That's a pretty decent one, but again, the original is the best.
I think the original's still best.
Yeah, haven't managed to get down an original copy, Al, but unfortunately in the 2012 reprint, they didn't include illustrations that were made then, so if people can contact us at DW Target Files with their memories of those illustrations, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah, it was great.
So, Al, should we round up thinking of The 10th Planet and the audiobook by Annika? Your score, please, mate, out of 10.
Definitely. It's a really interesting book, because it's the first one ever to have, you know, a regeneration and sort of modern days in Cybermen. So I really like the book, so I'll probably give that about an 8. And I think Annika's performance is fantastic. So I'd probably give that an 8.5, I think.
Similar for me, Al. I think we reviewed it elsewhere a few years ago, and I wasn't too enamoured with the actual text. But now we've had the audiobook version, the excitement of seeing this story round about Christmas time again, linked into Twice Upon a Time. I'm going to go 8 as well, mate. An 8 for me as well.
That is great. So I suppose we now need to discuss Twice Upon a Time.
A lovely intro, Al, into scenes from the 10th Planet, which we've seen before. Various little montage of people
great,
blowing up. We see Annika Wills, we see Michael Craze, we see William Hartnell. And then we get this lovely morph. What do you make of that morph from Hartnell to Bradley?
I think it's really good, because, you know, even people like my mum, who watched William Hartnell, couldn't tell that it wasn't William Hartnell from to begin with.
Well, that just goes to say it's very fabulous. Although we did get a reason when he comes across the Capaldi Doctor, 12, mentioning that the regeneration is sort of starting to begin, so that's why he doesn't look exactly like him. But really, as you've just explained with your mum's reaction, that's something only us picky fanboys are really going to get annoyed about.
I know, because I said to her, you know, do you think that's William Hartnell? And she went, well, of course it's William Hartnell. I went, no, it's David Bradley. She went, blimey, that's so close.
Absolutely. So he wanders out in the snow, as we saw on the 10th Planet, and comes across a mysterious Scottish accented figure on his knees in the snow. And we soon realise, or we knew already anyway, it's the 12th Doctor, Peter Capaldi. What did you make of that initial first meeting? Some lovely references in there to the TARDIS being bigger now, 12's TARDIS in the modern era, the windows being the wrong size, which is a big shout-out to Clayton Hickman and his seeming obsession with these details on Twitter, which we do love him for, though.
I just think those bits were really clever and they're really funny, the whole sort of, you know, this is not my TARDIS because the windows don't look right, and, you know, there's sort of jokes there and just firing off each other already between them. I thought they worked so well.
And that lovely idea of the frozen snowflakes.
Oh, yeah.
They're always frozen snowflakes, aren't they? But you know what I mean, the frozen time in midair.
Yeah, it just looked really good because, you know, you expect they're going to fall onto them and just stuck there. That's really, I really like that bit.
And then Mark Gatiss appears in Ypres in the 1914 World War I battle, holding a gun at a German soldier played by Toby Whithouse. So Moffat getting two of his writing pals back in there for this scene.
Oh, most definitely. That whole bit is so tense. And Gatiss, you know, pronouncing it, war is futile, basically. And then it's all frozen around him again.
And the are you trying to be funny scene, of course.
This is great.
Could you put me towards a doctor? And I've got to say, Mark's, I had feared, rewatching The League of Gentlemen, that Mark looked like one of the workmen in that story who gets abducted by the inbred couple, Edward and Tubbs. But I soon got over that, given his performance.
That was great, that bit.
And then we have the children in knee clip from a month ago. The lovely reveal into the TARDIS. You get that lovely pomposity of Hartnell, Bradley Doctor, don't you, saying, you're probably going to be in for a bit of a shock when you walk into this TARDIS. And then he stops, and of course it's 12's interior.
Yes, it's totally different to his.
And then we get the lovely bit of humour about, I presumed I'd be younger. We get the jokes about the brandy, don't we, and where it's gone in this 1500-year period.
Yeah, I know, that's great, those little bits.
Well, Peter Capaldi says that, but then if we include Heaven Sent, how long has he really... lived for, if you consider all the copies that were made of him each day?
I know, it's a real... I was trying to work that out myself, and I was thinking, is that right? 1,500 years? I couldn't quite work out if that's right or not.
And then we're in this grand sort of building with this grand staircase, and we find out there's a testimony going on. Now, people have wondered, as the episode goes on, spoilers, folk, there wasn't a huge villainous threat in this episode, was there? But do you feel that worked in the context?
I think, yeah, I'd agree. There wasn't really any sort of, you know, villain they had to fight against. But I think, because of the way the episode's laid out, you're not that bothered about that, to be honest.
Yeah, and of course gives us a lovely chance to see Pearl Mackie back again. So delightful to see her.
Oh, she's just so much fun in this episode. And the whole, there's lots of bits coming up. But the whole fact he can't get his head around her being alive again, really.
And I love these little shots they put in here now of the hug that's going on. And Hartnell's just sort of, I call him Hartnell, the first Doctor, is just sort of wondering what the heck is going on, really, just with his sort of look, doesn't he? His curious look towards them, you know? What is this hugging business? You almost expect him to say, but it's almost better that he doesn't, really, the way David Bradley plays the observation of that hug.
It's just really fun, and it's just sort of... I think exactly how the first Doctor would think, you know, you can't hug me.
And we get the whole principle of the sonic... screwdriver and the sunglasses, of course.
I can't find that bit funny again.
Yeah, it's a great bit of subversion. You can't really imagine, certainly during that era, Hartnell ever wearing those, can you?
No, not at all.
But it's funny in that it subverts that whole idea at the time. And what did you make of the whole idea of taking people's souls, Al? Two survivors a race.
It's an interesting concept, which I think, you know, works very well if you concept that, you know, everybody has memories and their memories are the more important than their souls, really. So I think it's an interesting one. I'm sure it's probably got complaints about it.
And we get the funny floating globes with all the previous Doctors in there.
Yeah, this is a great fun. It's just a shame that it wasn't audio described for some weird reason.
Yeah, and there were wonderful lines about the destroyer of Scarrow, the Valiant.
That bit was fine, but the actual footage of all the other Doctors wasn't audio described for some very weird reason.
And one getting this look of horror on his face now, doesn't he? I am not the Doctor of War.
Oh, you are eventually.
You will be, old man, you will be. A lovely introduction to the beautifully recreated First Doctor's TARDIS.
Oh,
what did you make of the direction and design in this, Al?
It's stunning from start to finish once they get inside.
Another podcast, Radio Free Scarrow interview with Rachel Talalay. she did mention at the time how often she'd watched The Tenth Planet, how much of the Hartnell era she'd watched, and they've really gone for it here. A bit of controversy about that. What would have been in the old days where the camera was placed as the fourth wall, in terms of how we moved on now and Peter's TARDIS is 360 degrees, and we know they can fit a camera anywhere in there. So they decided to put the hexagonal wall in from the curator in the National Gallery meeting Matt Smith's Doctor. Bit of controversy there, but I felt it blended in really well with the excellent recreation.
I think it works really nicely when you get that first little big shot of the control room of the first Doctor's TARDIS. I think it works beautiful, personally.
And I like the sort of stiff upper lip that Gatiss is playing this with now. Just sort of taking it in. Aren't these police boxes wonderful?
This is great. Any more brandy?
And then we arrive on Villegarden, isn't it? The one that was mentioned back in the Empty Child, the Doctor Dances. Many years ago now, at the start of the Moffat era, on Villegarden. And they quite a strange reintroduction of somebody who's going to be looking after the biggest database in the universe. Now, I was a bit confused. I thought they might have been returning to the library from Silence in the Library, given the Moffat connection here.
I was on the first watch. I couldn't quite work out why the Dalek was there. And then it took a second watch today, and then it sort of makes slightly more sense. I think that's a little bit of the wobbly bit of the episode, in my opinion.
Yes, into the Dalek, Rusty returning, the Dalek that it teleported away at the end. Not a hugely memorable part of the Peter Capaldi era for me, so slightly unusual return that.
Yeah, I did enjoy the episode when it was on originally, but I thought, you know, like you, they might have gone to the Matrix on Gallifrey or to the library, which would have made more sense. It's sort of, it's the only bit of the episode I have a few little wobbly issues with. I think it sort of doesn't quite work.
But then we're soon fan satisfied again, aren't we, back in the TARDIS. Mark Gatiss, mysterious captain character, says he'd like to get back to Cromer. Now, where have we heard that before in the Doctor Who universe, eh?
It's exactly where Lefferts Stewart comes from.
Who's that? Oh, no spoiler, who's that? Yeah, and I thought he really was channeling Nick Courtney, certainly for a few sentences in that scene.
Oh, this is some great bits. Definitely Nick Courtney was there in some bits, I think.
Did you prefer this as a denouement callback to the Brigadier than the Cyber Brig we got? You know, I pretty much, I'm one of the ones who liked the Cyber Brig at the time, and I also liked this callback as well.
I'm with you. I thought the Cyber Brig was quite good, but I think this more subtle approach, going, you know, I'm this part of the Lefferts Stewart family, you think this is just a really clever...
Yes, it's hard to go back and watch Death in Heaven now without thinking of the fan-made animations we've had of the Brigadier, you know, in the Cyberman suit with the moustache, fighting evil, the various fan-made photos we've had. You know, it's hard to take as seriously as the poignancy of this one, seeing his grandfather.
Definitely. I think they're fun, but I think this worked really well. It's a very quick moment of, you know, who are you and I'm this, and it works really well, I think.
And a certain Miss Potts is starting to reveal that she is, in fact, made of glass, to paraphrase Mr. Bradley later on. Now, we need to get onto this, Al, about the whole idea of sexism in this episode. What did you make of it? I don't really, you know, people have fairly pointed out that I don't really remember a lot of this in the Hartnell era. We certainly had Susan as the screaming companion, but Barbara Wright was very much a strong, assertive female, very much from the first episode.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, because, like you, I don't think there's much to it actually in the Hartnell period. Do you look at, you know, sort of all those females you have were quite, you know, feisty or strong or 1960s sort of outlook of feminism, but it came over, you know, quite in this episode, you know, they're just there to clean, where's Polly to clean, and, oh, you know, they are made of glass, and then, you know, but it sort of gets put back them by Bill, where she goes, oh yeah, I've had a few as well, and that sort of shuts them up, basically.
Oh, it's a fabulous reaction, isn't it? Brilliant one. But I did tend to roll my eyes then, listening back to The Tenth Planet, when there's a bit of a lull in the scene, isn't there, and Polly decides, what can I do? Oh, I'll go and make some tea.
Oh, no, it's terrible, isn't it? I think the other great scene in this, where he goes very old-fashioned, is when Bill's swearing, and the First Doctor has a nightmare, and he goes, I will spank your bottom
if young
you
lady.
Strong language.
Yeah, and someone did go back online and find a clip of Hartnell sort of threatening to do that to a companion, I think, at one point, so...
It's just hilarious, and the new Doctor, the 12th Doctor, is horrified by it.
B being men, Al, can we legitimately comment on this, do you think? You know, it depends how a woman might feel, you know, in terms of the feminism. Does it bring back those awful attitudes which were prevalent in society at the time?
I think they were more prevalent back then. We trying to be as politically correct as we are now in the 21st century, but it's still, I think, unfortunately, due to all the stuff that's been going on the last year, you know, with the Weinsteins and all that, it has sort of unfortunately slipped back. Well, it's coming out, thank God, you know.
But even even the phrase politically correct should be accepted now, isn't it? Because it just should be equal. It should be normal. You know, a normal thing for us to be polite to one another. God knows we need it in the world now.
Oh, totally, totally. You know, it just simply have to think, you know, it shouldn't be an extra thing you have to think about. I personally think it's to be, you know, women should always be treated right. You shouldn't have to think, oh, because she's a woman, you shouldn't say this. You just think, it's a woman, you wouldn't say it, basically.
And then we move towards the end of the episode. We return, and it seems as though the Brigadier's grandfather, spoilers, sorry, will have to be returned to pointing his gun at Toby Whithouse's German soldier. And then we get an absolutely beautifully shot montage by Talalay, beautifully scored by Murray Gold, who's having a bit of his greatest hits compilation in this episode.
Yeah, but it works, I think. I would agree. There are lots of bits of old Murray Gold music, and it's like there's the great 10th and 9th Doctor, the 10th Doctor theme, and all the sort of choral stuff from that sort of period, and it really works, I think, in this episode.
What really was going on, you know? How do they manage to get out of that predicament again? I've almost forgotten now, because I was so taken in by how beautifully this was shot, you know, just a field in somewhere in South Wales.
It's just so beautifully shot. I believe they have the Christmas Armitage, which is the, you know, bit where they all came together for several hours, and then
of
they went back
is, yeah.
to fighting afterwards, basically.
Yes, I feel incredibly stupid now for not realising that I was about to talk about the armistice, of course, and that was beautifully shot.
Oh, it was just stunning. Those shots there are just beautiful, you know, the whole Christmas carols and everybody coming together. But you all know, you know, now by the next day it was back to normal, unfortunately.
Indeed, indeed. And we get told that the Briggs grandfather's going to forget whatever's happened, but then we get the lovely shot of him appearing to see the Doctor across the trenches, and the Doctor just raises a glass, doesn't he, like he did with the salute in the cyber brig back three series ago.
It's just really subtle, you know. That, you know, you can see what he sees, the Doctor sort of saluting him, and he knows there's maybe some hope, hopefully.
And then as this episode went on, we knew, as they say nowadays, this was coming up to a part that was really going to hit you in the feels, as they say, as we saw Mr. Hartnell's Doctor, Mr. Bradley's, heading back to the scene in the 10th Planet, and we get an extra line added to him, don't we? And what did you make of the gold regen energy being brought in? I thought it was done very subtly. It wasn't too invasive.
It was really nice, I thought. It was just on the right level. It wasn't like covering him completely. It was like very gently done, and you saw, you know, that bit of Pat Troughton being there. Now, I just thought that was really nice, to be honest.
Got to say about the framing as it moved back to the old black and white picture. Rachel Talalay got that spot on, didn't she? The way Hartnell lies on the floor.
Yeah, because there's no. I've watched it on two different TVs, and even on my bigger TV, there's no judderiness. It sort of smoothly goes very subtly from you know the David Bradley Doctor into the old footage of Pat, and it works really well for what that scene did.
And then we go to the last 10 or so minutes, the end of probably, I think he's, I was going to say Eccleston before, the new series Doctors, maybe Smith. Well, they've all been great, but Peter's almost moving up to top spot now for me.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But where do you think Chris Chibnall kicked in?
In this episode, more or less when the Eye Morph was done, I think, later on. But shall we just talk briefly about the Returners before we talk about that final scene?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I just wondered, was that last speech what Capaldi does, was that still Moffat?
That was still Stephen. It was totally that Stephen Moffat until the Eye Morph, I think. As soon as Jodie appeared, I think that was... it was still Rachel directing?
Yeah, it's still Rachel directing. I just wondered where the actor... Because I know Chris started at some point.
The same with Tennant turning into Smith. It was Russell T. until Smith said his first words, the first scream.
Definitely, definitely.
And then we get the lovely scene now between the sadly departing Pearl Mackie talking about memories. And it's also a wonderful way to bring back the Doctor's two previous companions. And now we know we interviewed a certain Mr. Lucas, didn't we?
Oh, definitely.
Back in June, and he said he'd been to Cardiff the day before, which was unusual because the Series 10 had finished filming there, and we finally found out why on Christmas Day.
Because he had one final bit, basically, to tell the Doctor to live.
But even before that, they were talking about memories, and Bill had a present for the Doctor. Now, I did wonder at the time whether it was going to be Carol Ann Ford, because Peter has mentioned quite a few times at conventions in his era, yeah, that he would like Susan to come back.
But it wasn't. It was Gemma Coleman.
Yeah, who apparently filmed this on a lunch break for Victoria, and you can see it's been green-screened in, but it did certainly add to the ethereal quality of Clara.
Yeah, it was a really, it was like very, very short. It was very good.
And I suppose if we look at this and the return of Nardole just before the regeneration, it's a sign that perhaps with Moffat now, he's changed from Everybody Lives to Everybody Dies, because these are just memories, aren't they, of the companions uploaded to this database.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting outlook, you know, because he's sort of gone very dark with this whole you know, region episode. It's not a very light episode, you know, but there's enough comedy to keep it light, I think. So, but, you know, I think, yeah, you're right, it does have a very dark ending.
And being fans of the audio range, Al, we know that Mr. Moffat stuck Matt Smith's incarnation on Trenzalore, so there's a lot of gaps for Big Finish to fill in. And I guess we now have a lot of gaps for Bill and Nardole and Clara to appear in.
Yeah, that would be a very good, you know, if they could get the free, you never know, Big Finish, you know, they just finished doing the Daughter's Doctor, so you never know, it might happen at some point.
And that lovely cheekiness is there in Clara, isn't it, saying, "You stupid old man."
Yeah, you shouldn't. You forgot me, nearly. That's not nice.
Yeah, but I do wonder about the concept of this now, but does that mean there's some sort of trigger's gone off for the Time Lords and they will immediately start looking for her again, or was that sort of established that she was generally on the run until she takes that last breath after Face the Raven?
I'm not sure. I think there's something related to that. You know, you might see her back, I think.
And didn't you just love that bit where they were having the cuddle and Nardole just said, "Cuddle"?
It was great, wasn't it?
How can you not love Matt?
The whole invisible hair joke.
How can you not love Matt? On and off screen, folks, episode 36, he gave us a very kind interview for free. Lovely man.
It was just great.
And then he's talking about his hair being made of glass.
And then invisible, and then getting the lightning about his nipples. It's hilarious.
And he's about to go in. Off he goes. Now, this final speech, Al, wasn't sure how much I liked it at first, because I was perhaps unfairly comparing it to Matt Smith's final speech, which I absolutely adore. I've stated before it may be my favourite moment of Doctor Who ever.
But you've got to realise,
yeah, you've got to realise this is Stephen and this is Peter both saying goodbye, isn't it, to Doctor Who?
Yeah, basically.
As a whole in their lives, probably the last time they'll be involved on this regular basis with it anyway.
It's just so good, because it just builds and builds right to the end, and the whole thing about his name and children, it just gets better. I think on the first watch it wasn't that great,
and God, basic but stuff first, never be cruel, never be cowardly, Terence Dix, of course, from the Five Doctors.
Yeah,
never, never eat pears, that's been in the new series.
That's great.
Remember, he's saying, hate is always foolish, and I really love the way Rachel Talalay is really using that top rail here with the camera angles, isn't she?
It needed
to be done before they tear it down for the new one, and she's just using every possible trick in the book, and it comes off so well.
Oh, it does. There's some beautiful shots in this last scene with Peter. It's just, when he gets to talking about the children and they can hear his name, it's just so good. Right, and then that, you can see the agony when he's sort of just about to drop down and regenerate. It's just brilliant.
And these things he's used as a fan, you know, when he's dropping down and regenerating and he's about to say, "Doctor, I let you go." That comes back to Peter seeing him at a convention a few years ago saying when he was 18, 19, he threw away all his Doctor Who stuff. You know, he got into punk, he got into music, those sort of things. He thought Doctor Who was for children. But he's had this wonderful renaissance later in life of playing the character. And perhaps he's ready just to let go of it for a few years again. I think he might be back for Big Finish, maybe 3 or 4 years' time. It's a great sort of bookend, isn't it? And only children can hear your name. That's one of his ideas from an interview earlier this year, which Moffat put in.
Yeah, it's just great. I think there will be a break. He will go and do more anarchic stuff. As he said, he hasn't sworn for 4 years, so I think there will be sort of more grown-up stuff. And then it might come, but you never know.
And the laugh hard, the final speech, the pointing, laugh hard, run fast.
Yeah, that's
be kind. That's the key thing for everything, for fandom, for life, folks.
Definitely, definitely. And then there's the whole mammoth gold explosions, the best way of describing it.
Yeah, very reminiscent. Do you remember that first advert for his first season that Peter did? When he was on the telephone at the console? Very reminiscent of that.
That one with a mammoth explosion, and now kicking into Chris, you know, his direction now.
I found myself watching this saying out loud, here comes Chris, here comes Jodie. There's the eyes going. There's those beautiful eyes of Jodie's. And then, interesting shot. I've started to like this editing more. I didn't actually like it on broadcast, Al, but I've liked the use of camera angles to, first of all, represent the disorientation you must feel after regeneration, and then the chaos of the TARDIS crashing.
Because definitely, it does feel very sort of, you know, who am I sort of thing, and that's why when I've listened to it again here, I still couldn't quite understand what she's saying, but I think that's, you know, just as she's regenerating, you know, into her body, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite somber to start with, and then she looks up, she says, "Oh, brilliant!" Sounds like she's going to keep the Yorkshire accent, and I'm reminded of one of the first interviews I think she gave after being cast. And it was around about a week after her announcement, and people had already been to London Comic Con at that time and dressed in her outfit. And she was looking at the picture saying, "Oh, this was at Comic Con, you know, people have been cosplaying as me." "Oh, that's brilliant," she said. And I think they've taken that and made that into her first words. And it just seems so perfect for a female incarnation. But to me, Al, is it the same to you? It's almost as if it's still Peter's mind as of the Doctor, seeing that a woman's been cast saying, "Oh, brilliant."
Because I definitely thought that, because that line can be taken in so many ways. It can be like, "Oh, brilliant, this is fantastic," or, "Oh, brilliant, this is not what I wanted to be," basically.
Yeah, because the toothy grin is there as well, isn't it?
It's, yeah, that great grin she's got, and then the sort of the ring falling off, and then working out, "Oh, God, the TARDIS is on fire," basically.
But even not just Peter, you know, the toothy grin could be David Tennant with the whole Barcelona when he was first born as the Doctor. It could be Tom Baker with the wide eyes and the alien teeth.
Oh, definitely. There's a connection to all the old Doctors, I think, there. And I think it's going to be very interesting because, you know, it's going to continue straight from this, the first episode.
And then she gives us a wonderful sort of geeky finger push, doesn't she, onto the button, which starts seems to start the process anyway, blowing the TARDIS up. Why would you do that? You know, that's a strange thing, isn't it? That's the mystery.
Yeah, well, we all know why they're blowing the TARDIS up.
I don't think the Doctor herself is thinking, "Oh, we'd better see this in 4K, but I'm sure there'll be a reason for it. Chris Chibnall's going to give us.
Well, like it was last time when they put it into HD with Matt Smith.
What on earth is happening here? She's falling out.
That's the basic reason they're doing it.
People have had a little moan online saying, "Oh, it's the 11th hour again, it's crashing again." But no, it's going to be different. We didn't see the internal time rotor blow up, did we? We didn't see the time rotor blow up in the 11th hour.
No, it doesn't look like Earth she's falling into. It looks like a sort of more darker planet, what you can see.
Rumours it's going to be Sheffield. You know, that could be a dark planet to some people. Sorry, Sheffield. But and we get the lovely "to be continued," which is wonderful, isn't it?
Oh, it's great. And, you know, it's still going to be a bit of a gap. It's not going to be up to August, but it's, you know, I think it's going to be very, very good. I think it's going to get complaints, though.
Yeah, it's got me excited. We heard the fan show with Crystal D released online afterwards, and Stephen Moffat.
I haven't watched it. I have to watch it.
Yeah, you must watch it, Al. It's online on the BBC page, on YouTube and elsewhere.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. I will do that.
You know, Stephen Moffat gives his reaction to Jodie Whittaker, and he says, "Well, she made me laugh," and that's the main thing, isn't it? She does make you laugh. The sort of the giggly nature, it's there.
We want fun. I think though I love Peter Capaldi's era, it has been a bit dark.
It would have been awful, wouldn't it, if she'd come in and commented on her various shapes and bits and bobs as a lady. You know, that would have totally, I think, thrown people out of all sorts, you know, in terms of equality. "Oh, brilliant" was just perfect, I think.
It was just perfect. It's like, because that line can be taken, like, "Oh, brilliant, this is fantastic." It can be taken in so many different ways. And you just think maybe for the regen episodes, you might not be the happiest person thinking, "Oh, God, why am I a woman?" sort of angle, maybe.
But can we really judge from those opening few seconds of any Doctor what they're going to be like?
You can never judge. You can never judge what's going to happen. No, I don't say that. You could slightly judge how Peter was going to be.
Well, he was just more or less in shock, wasn't he, with the whole stare. And I mean, we had the eyebrow set up.
With the eyebrows, but he didn't say much. Joke, and it was quite... It was interesting, and then it went to being spat out of the dinosaur, didn't it, in the first...
Yeah, so I'm expecting something maybe a little bit lighter for the first episode, hopefully more really fast paced, like the 11th Hour, to suit with sort of a younger Doctor.
I think they want that audience. They really want that audience of younger viewers, because it has sort of dripped off. And did you see Charlie Ross's comment that he's got a life signed Dalek in his classroom?
Yes.
He asked 50% of his class what it was to do with, and they didn't know.
Charlie Ross, yeah, stand-up comedian, actor, works as a teacher as well, and just noticing on social media that a lot of people, he has a cardboard Dalek, doesn't he, in his room?
Yeah, and they didn't know. He asked them, you know, what is that? And about half his class didn't know, and they're all sort of either young or teenagers.
Whereas 5 years ago, they would have known.
They didn't know what it was.
Whereas 5 years ago, they would have known. So definitely got Chibnall, and now Jodie and the new team needing to capture the imaginations again of the kids, which is so important for the show.
I think it's definitely important, but I still like a smidgen of adultness to it. I'm one of these people, like, you know, happy episodes, but still have that sort of bit of darkness to it.
Oh, yeah, but Doctor Who can do anything. Family viewing, isn't it, Al? Family
viewing.
It
can do it all, and I really have good hopes for Jodie, because I know how good she can be.
What have you made of the whole Moffat era and the Capaldi era? What would you like to say about those two fine gents? And Murray Gold departing, of course.
Right, well, Stephen Moffat, nearly always episode, he always comes up with at least good episodes through his sort of era. And he's, as we said before in our podcast, there are quite a few that are stunning. There was always a few that weren't great, but most of the time you got really good episodes. You got good arcs, what started in the first and went to the last episode, and they were always really good sort of two-part episodes. So it will be a shame not having him, but I think it's a good thing, because I think he did a little bit too long. Peter Capaldi, fantastic from start to finish. Every episode, even the ones what I wasn't a big fan on, they were still watchable, and his sort of Doctor is definitely up there with one of my favourites. Murray Gold, who's now leaving, who was the music person, really fantastic musician. You know, there's lots of bits in the David Tennant period, in the Matt Smith period, and Peter Capaldi, you know, where the music just is essential to the episode, and it's all down to him. And, you know, we're very interesting to see where they go with the new music. But I think overall, it will be a shame, but it's change as always, and change is good, I think.
For me, start with Murray Gold. Fantastic. 12 years now, a heck of a long time to be in one job, but given us so many memorable tunes. I Am the Doctor, the 12th Doctor's theme in particular. For me, the various versions of the theme tune, not so keen on the Capaldi era one, but we shall see, and hopefully get a new one with Jodie, a new take on the classic Delia Derbyshire, Ron Grainer theme. So thank you for his work, Murray. Best of luck to him in the future. Stephen Moffat, thank you so much for all the hard work down these years. Sometimes I do wonder, do we necessarily need a showrunner? Perhaps they input too many scripts within a series, I do wonder about, Al, you know, and perhaps they don't get enough time to refine some of their stories. But saying that, he's given us some absolute stone-cold classics, the ones we discussed, The Girl in the Fireplace, The Empty Child, Doctor Dances, Silence in the Library before he became showrunner, The 11th Hour, Time of Angels, Flesh of Stone, Day of the Doctor. I'm going to say Time of the Doctor, even though we had it middling in our hit-and-miss specials. This Twice Upon a Time, so many great, great episodes. Flatline, Mummy on the Orient Express. I could just list them and list them. Thank you so much, Stephen. I do hope you contribute again in the future to Doctor Who. And finally, Peter Capaldi, just a genuinely top bloke. Managed to meet him twice. Whether he's an actor or not, I really don't think it was put on. I think he was genuinely interested in speaking to the fans, showing you his love of the show. If he needs to have a rest from it now before he does Big Finish, maybe to be persuaded in a few years, good luck to him. Look forward to seeing so much more for him. Wouldn't be surprised to see him turn up in either maybe Van Helsing or the original role if they go older in the new Gatiss and Moffat Dracula that's coming up. I wouldn't be surprised to see him in that with those eyebrows. And thank you so much, Peter. A wonderful era. And on to the future. Hello, Jodie. Really enthused by what you've brought in a few seconds and those brief few words. And thank you, Chibnall. Looking forward to seeing what you've got as well, Chris. So the future is exciting again, Al.
Oh, most definitely. I would agree completely with that. There are just too many Stephen Moffat episodes to mention because they were great. But yeah, there's a very, I didn't think about that. That's a very interesting idea of having Capaldi maybe as, you know, in that new Dracula version, what Gatiss and Moffat are working on apparently next year.
But I have a feeling they'll go young like they did for Sherlock with Benedict, though. Maybe even be Benedict, you know, for Dracula.
He could pull Dracula off, because Benedict can be nasty as well as nice, so... an interesting one, definitely. I think he'll be involved somehow, maybe, you know, Van Helsing and that, if they have a Van Helsing or somebody.
Okay, and finally, Al, shall we say any entertainment recommendations you've seen over Christmas?
What have I seen over Christmas? It's been a lot. I, of course, enjoyed Twice Upon a Time. Then we had Little Women, done very well by the BBC. We had The Minitress, which was a very interesting sort of Dutch English book about sort of the 1850s. Very good. Fun wise, we have to say The League of Gentlemen, that was brilliant over Christmas. I watched the Oasis biopic, and that was very interesting. It's just been lots on. The box is pretty full at the moment. How about you?
Yes, I just want to praise League of Gentlemen return as well. Three new episodes, like they'd never been away. Certain PC things were dealt with really well this time, I thought. Definite shades of Brexit. One absolutely fantastic scene with Mark Gatiss playing a bingo caller. It just shows what a fantastic actor he is, right up there with the Stackpole Cave tragedy monologue in the first series. He played this bingo caller.
It was just great, wasn't it?
I'd like to see him get an award for that monologue. So, Mark, what a fabulously talented man. I think Chibnall might have been in touch with him. I hope he writes for Doctor Who again. And perhaps he'll act in it again, because he was excellent as the Briggs grandfather. And I think he's thoroughly entertained us this Christmas. So Mark Gatiss is probably my man of Christmas, acting-wise, if that's such a thing. I don't know.
I would agree with that, but it's just a little bit annoying while they're charging so much for their League of Gentlemen tour they're doing.
We shall talk about that, Al, shan't we? So
But I think isn't the Reeves and Mortimer on tonight?
9 o'clock tonight with Matt Lucas. Told us he was returning for that, didn't we, earlier in the summer? So we shall look forward to it.
That should be great fun as well. We'll probably be watching that.
So Vic and Bob, hopefully just looking a bit more grey, but hopefully still with that fabulous humour which was born back then in the mid to late 80s.
That's why I think The League of Gentlemen really worked, because we both worried that it was going to be watered down, and they just went, no, it's the same. But if it's the same, it was brilliant. That's why I think Inside Number 9 is going to be great next week.
Yes, Al, and Happy New Year to all our listeners.
Oh, most definitely. I hope you have a great one, and, you know, get merry on New Year's Eve, have fun. Look forward to a new year. It's always that sort of, you know, oh, it's January, it's a bit dull and miserable, but, you know, it's a new year and lots of things will happen, so enjoy it.
A long time till new TV Doctor Who, probably August, September, folks, but an exciting year for Target releases. We're getting versions of new stories, of course, including Twice Upon a Time by Paul Cornell, I believe, is going to adapt it.
It is, and we've got Rose, we've got The Christmas Invasion. There's lots of very nice and big Target stuff coming next year. We've also got quite a lot of the old stuff that's finally coming out on audio and books, probably.
Robots of Death, I'm looking forward to, read by Louise Jameson. I think Mark of the Rani by Nicola Bryant. Those are two within the first few months of the year, I think. And we're going to discuss a John Pertwee story next, Al. I'll let you know in a minute, but I've already recorded the Next Time trailer, okay?
Fantastic. That's great. Well, have a Happy New Year, everybody.
Yes, thanks for listening, folks. Happy New Year. Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, we'll be discussing Doctor Who, The Ambassadors of Death, written by Terence Dix, and audiobook performed by Jeffrey Beavers. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for our podcast page. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, The Tenth Planet and Twice Upon a Time review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. 12th Doctor theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version 4 of the podcast, by Veil Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel of that name, V-A-Y-L-E Mystery. Newsround opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, 10th Planet, and Twice Upon a Time Review was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during December 2017.